This morning, I'm going to be reading from a book called Gifts He Left Behind, which are it's called the Dhamma Legacy of Pra Ajahn Dun Atulo, usually referred to as Longpu Dun. And this is a book, I believe it was done in 2005, sometime either 2004, 2005, translated by Ajahn Jeff from a book that had been done in Thai already. They're very short teachings. Not one of them is more than one page. So in a way, you could say they're not necessarily ideal for reading in succession like this. But I thought to give a taste, a flavor of his teachings, and it may inspire people to pick up this book and ponder them, because in a way, the way I use this book is to just read like one teaching and then consider that. So that's for quite a long time. I'll begin by reading, there's an introduction, there's a biographical sketch, which is very short, and then an introduction. And then I'm going to jump to the last few reflections, which actually deal with the end of his life. And then I'll go back and just read a selection of these teachings, okay? And I do apologize in advance for my pronunciation of some of the Thai names. So I'm pretty hopeless, so... Many people have asked for Longpu's Dhamma talks out of a desire to read them or listen to them. And I have to confess frankly that Longpu's Dhamma talks are extremely rare. This is because he never gave any formal sermons or discourse at any great length. He simply taught meditation, admonished his students, answered questions, or discussed the Dhamma with other elder monks. He would speak in a way that was brief, careful, and to the point. In addition, he never gave sermons at formal ceremonies. So in response to the desire and interest that many people have shown in Longpu's Dhamma, I have compiled this book of his short teachings, pure truths at the highest level, lessons and admonishments he gave his students, answers to questions, and passages from the Buddha's words in the canon that he always liked to quote. Because I lived with him for a long time, to the end of his life, I have gathered these passages from memory or from notes I took. I have also included the events, locations, and people who were involved to help make the passages easier to understand and more inviting to read. It was remarkable and amazing that even though Longpu normally wouldn't speak or would speak as little as possible, he was still very quick and astute in his expression, never missing his mark. His words were brief but full of meaning, every sentence containing a message complete in itself. It was as if he would hypnotize his listeners, forcing them to ponder his words for a long time with their deepest discernment. The reader, noticing that some of the passages here contain teachings that are ordinary, some that are amusing, and some that are pure truth on the ultimate level, may wonder why they weren't placed in ascending order, from easy to difficult, or from low to high. The reason I didn't place them in order like that is because each passage is complete on one page, and I wanted to vary the atmosphere. If this is inappropriate, unseemly, or faulty in any way, I ask that all those who are learned will be kind enough to forgive me, an author of very little intelligence. And that was written by a monk, I believe he lived with Lumpur Dun for about 30 years. His name was Pra Kru Nandapanya Bharana. And that was written in July 1985, just as this book was compiled. So,
when Longpu died, something like, I don't know, 83, 84 or something.
Yeah.
And he was, Ajahn Chah was admitted to Julian Longkorn Hospital. This is when the Queen sort of put a proposal to have Ajahn Chah come down and receive treatment from the best sort of neurosurgeons that Thailand had, and see if they could do anything to help Ajahn Chah. And that was where he spent quite a few months. That was after during the Rains Retreat of 82 or so. And then he Sangha deciding, okay, Ajahn Chah's not getting better, we'll bring him back to look after him at Wat Pa Pong. Shortly after that, the Buddha got sick, and he was taken to the same suite as there was a large kind of suite in Jualongkorn Hospital, place for look after Ajahn Chah, place to receive guests, place for the attendant monks to be there.
Nice. That's a nice anecdote. Here's a brief biographical sketch. Pra Ajahn Dun Atilo was born on October 4th, 1888, in Prasat village in Muang district, Surin province. At the age of 22, he ordained in the provincial capital. 6 years later, disillusioned with his life as an uneducated town monk, he left to study in Ubon Ratchathani, where he met Ajahn Singh Kanit Yagamo and reordained in the Dhammayut sect. Shortly thereafter, he and Ajahn Singh met Ajahn Mun Buridatto, who had just returned to the northeast after many years of wandering. Impressed with Ajahn Mun's teachings and with his deportment, both monks abandoned their studies and took up the wandering meditation life under his guidance. They were thus his first two disciples. After wandering for 19 years through the forests and mountains of Thailand and Cambodia, Ajahn Dun received an order from his ecclesiastical superiors to head a combined study and practice monastery in Surin. It was thus that he took over the abbotship of Wat Buripa in the middle of the town in 1934. There he remained until his death in 1983. As one of the most senior members of the forest tradition founded by Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Dun was widely known as Luang Pu, a term of great respect and affection meaning Venerable Grandfather. So now I'll jump to the last days of his life, the last months at least. Title of this short talk is His Last Illness. When Luang Pu returned from the hospital in early 1983, it didn't mean that he had fully recovered from his illness. Simply that he had to use an extreme level of endurance to survive for 8 more months to the special merit-making celebration that had been planned for his 96th birthday. As the day of the ceremony approached, his symptoms started getting erratic. He'd be very tired, uncomfortable, and feverish from time to time. I asked him if we should take him back to Chulalongkorn Hospital, but he said, "There's no need to." And then he added, "I forbid you to take me, for even if I went, I wouldn't recover." I replied, "Last time your illness was heavier than this and you still recovered. This time it's not heavy at all. You're sure to recover." Luang Pu said, "That was last time. This isn't last time." On October 29th, 1983, so about 4 weeks after his birthday that he was waiting to celebrate, Luang Pu's condition was no better than stable after 1 p.m., but his complexion was abnormally bright. His followers, lay people, town monks, and forest monks, came in large numbers for the celebration. At 3 p.m., a large contingent of forest monks came to pay respect to Luang Pu, who sat up and discussed the Dhamma with them. Speaking in a clear voice, he advised them on the entire path of practice as if he were resolving all their doubts and questions, summarizing all the meditation instructions he had ever taught. Later that night, near 10 p.m., Luang Pu had us take him out of his hut in a wheelchair. He looked gently around the whole area of the monastery, with no one realizing that that would be his last look at things outside. One last recollection of the Dhamma. After 10 p.m., Luang Pu had us take him back into his room. He lay on his back, supported by a large pillow. He asked the 8 or 9 monks in the room to chant the 7 blessings chant for him to hear. Then he told them to chant the Sati Sambojanga Sutta 3 times and Dependent Core Rising 3 times. Then he asked us to chant the great frames of reference, the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. But none of us had memorized it. So he said, "Open your chanting books and chant from the book." But there were no chanting books around. Fortunately, Ajahn Punsak, who had been looking after Luang Pu all along, had brought his copy of the royal chanting book. So he picked it up and searched through the book to find the right page, leafing back and forth until Lungpo said, "Hand it here." He then opened the book to the right page without even looking at it and said, "Chant from right here." This amazed every monk in the room, for Lungpo had opened the book right to the Mahasatipatthana discourse on page 172. The discourse was long, and it took us more than 2 hours to finish it. He listened quietly throughout. A few moments after we had finished chanting the Mahasatipatthana discourse, Lungpo began speaking about the Lord Buddha's total Nibbana, from the beginning to the end. Here, I'll ask just to quote his concluding remarks. "The Lord Buddha didn't attain Nibbana in any of his jhanic attainments. When he left the fourth jhana, his mental aggregates all ceased at once, with nothing remaining. In other words, he allowed his feeling aggregate to cease in an awake state of mind, the normal human mental series, complete with mindfulness and alertness, with no other mental states coming to blind or delude the mind at all. This was the mind fully in its own state. You could call that state great emptiness, or the original cosmos, or Nibbana, whichever you like. That's the state I've been practicing all along to reach." Those were Lungpo's last words. A moment of wilderness in the city. Let's go back in time for a moment to some events nearly 100 years ago. Lungpo's group of four wandering monks and novices had split off from Ajahn Mun's group and were wandering through the Ta Kanto district in Kalasin province. As they went through the dense forest, they encountered all sorts of dangers and difficulties, every kind of wild animal, and in particular, malaria. Finally, one of the monks, unable to fight off the disease, died in a pitiful way right in front of his fellow monks. Worse than that, when Lungpo split off from the group, accompanied by just one small novice, into another forest wilderness near Kut Kam village, malaria came and took the life of the novice right before his eyes. Lungpo couldn't do nothing but look on in utter dismay, simply because he lacked the medicine to treat the disease. Now come back to the events just after 4 a.m. on October 30th, 1983. So this is the morning that he died. That same condition of wilderness returned for a moment in Lungpo's room. For although he was seriously ill, there wasn't a single nurse, not a single drop of saline solution anywhere around. There were simply Lungpo's monastic students circled around him, as if protecting his total freedom to put down his body in a death that left no traces, completely pure, quiet, and calm. So now I'll go back to near the beginning and I'll do selected readings. I won't read all of them, but I picked out a number of them and we'll just see how far we get. On December 18th, 1979, Their Majesties the King and Queen paid a private visit to Lungpo. After asking about his health and well-being and engaging in Dhamma conversation, the King posed a question. "In abandoning the defilements, which one should be abandoned first?" Lungpo responded, "All the defilements arise together at the mind. Focus right at the mind. Whichever defilement arises first, that's the one to abandon first." On the Four Noble Truths. A senior monk of the meditation tradition came to pay his respects to Lungpo on the first day of the rains retreat in 1956. After giving him instruction and a number of teachings on profound matters, Lungpo summarized the Four Noble Truths as follows. The mind sent outside is the origination of suffering. The result of the mind sent outside is suffering. The mind seeing the mind is the path. The result of the mind seeing the mind is the cessation of suffering. Real, but not for real. It's normal that when people practicing concentration start getting results, they can have their doubts about what they've experienced. For example, when they experience conflicting visions or start seeing parts of their own bodies. Many people came to Lungpo asking him to resolve their doubts or to give them advice on how to continue with their practice. And a lot of people would come to say that when meditating, they saw hell or heaven or heavenly mansions or else a Buddha image inside their body. Was what I saw real? They would ask. Longpu would respond, "The vision you saw was real, but what you saw in the vision wasn't." Letting go of visions. So this is a continuation from the previous one. The questioner might then ask, "You say that all these visions are external and that I can't yet put them to any use. If I stay stuck simply on the vision, I won't make any further progress. Is it because I've been staying so long with these visions that I can't avoid them? Every time I sit down and meditate, as soon as the mind gathers together, it goes straight to that level. Can you give me some advice on how to let go of visions in an effective way?" Longpu would respond, "Oh, some of these visions can be lots of fun and really absorbing, you know? But if you can stay stuck right there, it's a waste of time. A really simple method for letting go of them is not to look at what you see in the vision, but to look at what's doing the seeing. Then the things you don't want to see will disappear on their own." External things. On December 10th, 1981, Longpu participated in the annual celebration at Wat Dhammamongkon on Sukhumvit Road in Bangkok. A large number of temporarily ordained women from a nearby teacher's college came to discuss the results of their vipassana practice, telling him that when their minds settled down, they would see a Buddha image in their hearts. Some of them said that they saw the heavenly mansions awaiting them in heaven. Some saw the Chulamani Stupa, which has a little parenthesis here, a memorial to a relic of the Buddha kept in heaven. It's a Chulamani Stupa. They all seemed very proud of their success in their practice of vipassana. Lumpu said, "All the things that appeared for you to see are still external. You can't take them as a substantial refuge at all." Stopping to know. In March 1964, a large number of scholarly and meditating monks, the first group of Dhamma missionaries, came to pay their respects to Longpu and to ask for teachings and advice that they could use in their work of spreading the Dhamma. Longpu taught them Dhamma on the ultimate level, both for them to teach others and for them to put into practice themselves so as to reach that level of truth. In conclusion, he gave them a piece of wisdom for them to take and contemplate. "No matter how much you think, you won't know. Only when you stop thinking will you know. But still, you have to depend on thinking so as to know." On the ultimate level, there's no desire. Before the rains retreat in 1953, Luang Pa Ta, a relative of Lumpu's who had ordained late in life, returned from many years of wandering with Ajahn Tait and Ajahn Sam in Pangna province to pay his respects to Longpu and to learn more about meditation practice. He spoke with Longpu on familiar terms, saying, "Now that you've built an ordination hall and this large, beautiful meeting hall, you've probably reaped a really huge amount of merit." Longpu replied, "What I built was built for the general good, the good of the world, of the monastery, and of the religion. That's all. As for reaping the merit, what would I want with merit like this?" Teaching him a lesson. 6 years after the World War II was over, the legacy of the war remained in the form of the poverty and difficulties caused by the shortages of food and materials that affected every home. In particular, there was a great shortage of cloth. If a monk or novice had even one complete set of robes, he was fortunate. "I was one of a large number of novices living with Longpu. One day, novice Prom, another one of Longpu's nephews, saw novice Chumpon wearing a beautiful new robe. So he asked him, 'Where did you get that robe?' Novice Chumpon told him, I was taking my turn attending to Longpu. He saw that my robe was torn, so he gave me a new one. When it came Novice Prom's turn to give Longpu a foot massage, he wore a torn robe with the idea that he'd get a new robe too. When he had finished his duties and was leaving, Longpu noticed the tear in the robe and was struck with pity for his nephew. So he got up, opened a cabinet, and handed his nephew something, saying, "Here, sew that up. Don't go around wearing a robe all torn like that." Disappointed, the novice had to quickly accept the needle and thread from Lungpu's hand. Inspired words, more inspired words. And this is directly quoting from Lungpu. "When you can separate the mind from its involvement with all things, the mind is no longer tied to sorrow. Whether sights, sounds, smells, tastes, or tactile sensations are good or bad depends on the mind's going out to fashion them in that way. When the mind lacks discernment, it misunderstands things. When it misunderstands things, it gets deluded under the influence of all things that are binding, both physically and mentally. The ill effects and punishments we suffer physically are things from which other people can help free us, to at least some extent. But the ill effects within the mind, to which the mind is in bondage through defilement and craving, are things from which we have to learn to free ourselves on our own. The noble ones have freed themselves from ill effects of both sorts, which is why suffering and stress can't overcome them." Still more inspired words. "When a person has shaved his hair and beard and put on the ochre robe, that's the symbol of his state as a monk. But it counts only on the external level. Only when he has shaved off the mental tangle, all lower preoccupations, from his heart can you call him a monk on the internal level. When a head has been shaved, little creeping insects like lice can't take up residence there. In the same way, when a mind has gained release from its preoccupations and is freed from fabrications, suffering can't take up residence at all. When this becomes your normal state, you can be called a genuine monk." What Bhutto is like. Longpu was invited to teach in Bangkok on March 31st, 1978. During a Dhamma conversation, some lay people expressed their doubts about what Bhutto was like. Longpu was kind enough to answer. "When you meditate, don't send your mind outside. Don't fasten on to any knowledge at all. Whatever knowledge you've gained from books or teachers, don't bring it in to complicate things. Cut away all preoccupations. And then, as you meditate, let all your knowledge come from what's going on in the mind. When the mind is quiet, you'll know it for yourself. But you have to keep meditating a lot. When the time comes for things to develop, they'll develop on their own. Whatever you know, have it come from your own mind. The knowledge that comes from a mind that's quiet is extremely subtle and profound. So let your knowledge come out of a mind quiet and still. Have the mind give rise to a single preoccupation. Don't send it outside. Let the mind stay right in the mind. Let the mind meditate on its own. Let it be the one that keeps repeating Bhutto, Bhutto. And then genuine Bhutto will appear in the mind. You'll know for yourself what Bhutto is like. That's all there is to it. There's not a whole lot." For those who want something good. In early September 1983, so this is just 1 month before Lumpur died, the Housewives Association of the Interior Ministry, led by Mrs. Joap Girarot, came to the Northeast to do some charity work. One evening, they took the opportunity to stop by and pay their respects to Longpu at 6:20 p.m. After they had paid their respects and asked after his health, they received some amulets from him. Seeing that he wasn't feeling well, though, they quickly left. But there was one lady who stayed behind and took his special opportunity to ask Longpu, "I'd like something good from Longpur too, which is a euphemism for also receiving an amulet. Longpur replied, "You have to meditate to get something good. When you meditate, your mind will be at peace. Your words and deeds will be at peace. Your words and deeds will be good. When you live in a good way like this, you'll be happy." The lady replied, "I have lots of duties and no time to meditate. My government work has me all tied up, so where am I going to find any time to meditate?" Longpur explained, "If you have time to breathe, you have time to meditate." He does, but he doesn't. In 1979, Longpur went to Chantaburi to rest and to visit with Ajahn Somchai. On that occasion, a senior monk from Bangkok, Pra Dhammavaralongkorn of Wat Buparang, the ecclesiastical head of the southern region of the country, was also there, practicing meditation in his old age, being only 1 year younger than Longpur. When he learned that Longpur was a meditation monk, he became interested and engaged Longpur in a long conversation on the results of meditation. He mentioned his responsibilities, saying that he had wasted a lot of his life engaged in study and administration work well into his old age. He discussed different points of meditation practice with Longpur, finally asking him, "Do you still have anger? Do you still have any anger?" Longpur immediately answered, "I do, but I don't pick it up." I'll finish there. Did I hear correctly the other day that you met him?
Yeah, I met him at first met him at Wat Nam Chai. He came to Wat Nam Chai and visited. I can't remember why. He brought a group of lay people and had me give a talk. And then he invited me, I think once or twice, down to his monastery to join in ceremonies and give a talk. He's very quiet, but he's not taciturn. He's just quiet, quiet, still. He's interested in people, warm, friendly, but it didn't engage very much. Where some people who are quiet, there's kind of grumpy and not very well disposed to other human beings, but he's very warm. He just wasn't interested in talking. So that's like a lot of his teachings were just like those, were just very short, pithy, guidance, instruction, pointers maybe, and relying on his experience.
Yeah. Were you just a new habit then?
Fairly new, yeah. Because the first time that I met him, I remember it was fairly new because he was such a senior monk and I'd heard of him. He's one of the original Ajahn Mun disciples, and he invited me to talk to this group of lay people, and I remember saying, feeling almost, aghast, and saying to them, I don't feel comfortable getting up on a Dhamma seat while you're here and talking Dhamma while such a senior monk is, it seems like such a waste to have like a young whippersnapper like me teaching these people. And while you're here, and he said, and it was just sort of, no, 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 go. to get, I had to get up. But I remember that, because it was really, it was fairly, fairly early on in my being the abbot of Wat Namachan.
This monastery is also quite loud, isn't it?
There's a neat little story in there as well.
It describes how there's one in the, later on in the book that describes how there's lots of festivals go on. Yeah. Used to go on for sometimes up to 15 days.
Well, there's an elephant festival in Surin, it's renowned throughout the country, and. Because also, it was built. The monastery was built on the edge of town. There's a forest monastery on the edge of the town, about 50 years before. But then, the population grew, and it turned into a larger city. So it was a provincial capital, and then they moved the whole provincial administration out to beside the monastery, basically. So then the provincial exhibition grounds were right there. So when the elephant festival was going on, it's not just elephants, it's all of the entertainment and movies and bands playing and whatnot at the same time.
Go ahead
and read that. Okay.
Yeah, I think this is the one.
It's a really.
It's easy if you're not attached. That's the title of the.
Oh, right.
It's easy if
Right here.
What word, Pa?
Just a sec.
Oh, sorry. Wat Burapa, where Lumpu spent each rains retreat without exception for 50 years, is situated in the heart of the town of Surin, right in front of the provincial offices and next to the provincial court. For this reason, the noise of cars and trucks was constantly disturbing the peace and quiet of the monastery. Especially during the annual elephant fair or any of the holidays, there would be noise and bright lights for 7 or 15 days at a time. The monks and novices, whose minds still lacked resilience, would be especially bothered by this. Whenever they bring this to Lungpu's attention, they'd always get the same response. Why waste your time being interested in those things? It's the nature of light to be bright. It's the nature of noise to be loud. That's what their functions are. If you don't focus on listening, that's the end of the matter. Act in a way that's not in opposition to your surroundings, for that's just the way they are. Simply reach a genuine understanding with them using deep discernment. That's all.
Big one.
Even at the Vimutti Monastery, while I was there, Auckland, incorporated all the little towns around it to make it part of a super city. So he's out in the countryside, but literally just on the other side of the road is now the city limits.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just across the road. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Potentially, same thing could happen.
Still a long way away.
You can see it at night, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading that, Reverend Unsher, anytime he would get around Master Bot, he would his meditation object would just become so clear. And I was just wondering if you would experience that when you would go and pay respects to different group ajahns, like Ajahn Dun in particular, or Ajahn Chah, if there was a particular running theme which would come up in your heart or whatever.
Well, it's always it's always helpful to meet these great beings, great masters, and I think one of the things is the reason
meditation object comes clear is because of a sense of hiriyotapa, a deference, respect that's there. So then there's a increased vigilance within the mind, and then the mind becomes clear. So it, and I think that so much of the chaos that's in our minds tends to fall away out of when we become close to somebody that we're very respectful of, or if we know that they're, or we suspect that they actually can track your mental states, then there's a certain trepidation that keeps the mind focused. and that helps the mind become very settled in its meditation. A lot of it is, I think, just the faith, respect, and being able to sustain that.